When he was 6 or 7 years old, Nelson Fuzzy Thompson went to the American Royal Parade with his mother. She took him to get a juicy hot dog on a buttered bun from what turned out to be a segregated lunch counter. Normally, he would have enjoyed eating the hot dog outside, but it was bitterly cold. And learning that he wasn't welcome to sit inside was his introduction to the civil rights movement. Good morning, I'm Gina Kaufman. Today is the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, barring discrimination in public facilities. On this momentous occasion, we look back on the struggle for civil rights here in Kansas City. What stories still need to be told? Tune in for that and more right after this news. At 6:45 p.m. Eastern Time 50 years ago, Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act. At that moment, discrimination in places like hotels, theaters, and restaurants became illegal in this country. And a moment is about all it took for Kansas City's civil rights proponents to act on the big news. That very evening, members of the Congress for Racial Equality, also known as CORE, showed up at a barber shop in the Hotel Muehlbach requesting haircuts, which could no longer legally be denied based on race. Good morning. I'm Gina Kaufman. Joining me today are two wonderful guests who can tell us about Kansas City's own dynamic civil rights movement. First, let me introduce Anita Dixon. She's the executive director of the Mutual Musicians Foundation at 18th and Vine, and she used to lead Kansas City history tours from an African-American perspective. Hi, Anita.
Good morning.
What prompted you to start leading these tours? Did you think there were gaps in people's understanding of local history or even national history?
Well, actually, what prompted me to lead these tours was the understanding that there was a huge market for African-American history that was not being supplied. There were a number of African-American conferences and meetings and churches that were coming to town, and the rich history of African-American Kansas City was not being done on a tour like other tours, like the Fountain Tour and various things like that. So I compiled that history and put that together for that specific market.
I want to introduce our other distinguished guests as quickly as possible, but before I do, Anita, how would you characterize the civil rights movement here in Kansas City?
Well, as a child of the children, I mean a literal child of the civil rights movement, I have to say that Kansas City was probably one of the most participatory cities in understanding of the things that were happening. We had the Bernard Powells, the Leon Jordans, and the various people that actually stood up.
These were big leaders here in town.
Huge leaders that are memorialized today. So as a literal child, a little kid watching these things, I was always bolstered and always honored to be in their presence or to understand more of what they did because it helped shape the person I became later on.
Well, were there sit-ins and other kinds of things like you hear about nationally that were hallmarks of the movement here?
You know, when I look at it from a perspective, because I'm 58 years old, and when I look at it at the perspective of what I was when I was a child, I heard the stories, I watched the people. I wasn't participating because I was a kid, but I heard the stories, I watched the people, I watched my own mother and people in my church and the signs and stuff. So they're very vivid within my mind.
Joining us now is someone who does remember it firsthand, who more than participated. Reverend Nelson Fuzzy Thompson is president of the local chapter of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and he's been part of pretty much every milestone for civil rights progress here in town. It's an honor, Reverend Thompson.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
When were you born?
December 3rd, 1944.
And what was Kansas City like for you growing up? How aware were you of segregation and from what age?
Well, it was certainly segregated. I don't know how aware I was of it. I just assumed that's the way things were. And slowly but surely, my mother, who worked downtown as a matron in the insurance exchange, the Board of Trade, and the Dwight Building, by me going downtown and spending time with her and she taking me to shop and the American Royal Parade and different things like that, she slowly but surely taught me that it was segregated and that it was going to be my responsibility to change that.
Do you remember the first time you felt a need to take some kind of action or to participate in an effort to change things?
Well, I remember the first time that I clearly experienced segregation and I understood what it was. I don't know if I took any action. I was only about 7, 8 years old, and it was during the American Royal Parade. My mother used to take me over to W.T. Grant's downtown and get those big, juicy hot dogs on a butter bun with relish and mustard. And we'd always really enjoy those. Well, this particular day was kind of chilly because the parade was in November and it was cold. And we got the hot dogs, and then I wanted to go over and sit down in the warmth and enjoy them. And my mother became quite agitated and said, we can't sit down and eat here.
Did you understand why not?
No, I didn't. But she told me also, you're going to have to, in your lifetime, change that.
How did you come to understand what she meant?
Well, I understood after she told me. I could tell that it was something that she was uncomfortable with and she didn't like by her sudden agitation. And I could also tell that she expected me to accept the responsibility for making the difference. And that's when I began to realize that there were lots of things that needed to be changed and that I was going to have to be involved in the struggle to change them.
Was your involvement initially as a reverend?
No, actually it was as a teenager.
Tell us about that.
There was a restaurant in Kansas City, Kansas on Minnesota Avenue called D'Angelo's. They refused to serve black people and said they would close down before they served a black person. And I remember being involved with CORE, incidentally, and the Reverend Cecil Williams, who was our pastor at that time, in a march. We marched outside the restaurant. And in fact, they didn't ever serve black people. They did close.
So they stayed true to their word,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, they did. And I remember they instructed us before the march to remain nonviolent. Don't say anything. Don't respond to anybody. And if anybody says anything to you, just go limp and leave it alone.
I feel like that must take some kind of almost superhuman self-discipline.
It does.
Can you describe how you cultivated that or what you were thinking, how you could be nonviolent and just limp in the face of people being sort of cruel to you?
Well, when I was young, it was very difficult. And when I went through, actually, when I went through college, I went through a stage of where I sort of rejected. I was militant, as many young people were. And I was involved in the black liberation struggle. And some of the involvement was, it was nonviolent, but it was pretty much action. I fought back.
A little more confrontational.
Somewhat. I was definitely confrontational. And then as I got older and began to read and study and became a follower of Dr. King and his philosophy of nonviolence and what that meant and how you could use nonviolence as an action tool.
Well, I want to get to the Civil Rights Act of 1964 shortly because the 50th anniversary of that piece of legislation is what brings us here today. But first, can we talk about just a few years leading up to that? Because a lot of things happened in Kansas City during that time. What was your role in the community during the early 1960s, the period we're talking about?
Well, I graduated from college in 1968. So a lot of that time I was in college, I was in high school, I was a youngster, I was militant, and I was learning the movement, I was reading history. I had never really delved into it before that time.
Well, let's talk about it just as a group, both you and Anita. In February 1959, after some pickets, three department stores announced that they were ending their segregation policies. Was that a big deal that you were aware of?
Yes, it was a big deal. In fact, my mother was involved in some of those demonstrations. As I said earlier, she worked downtown. And our pastor at that time, I won't call his name, he objected to her being involved in it.
Really?
And many of the young women in the church, he objected, young men and young women, he objected to them being involved at that level.
On what grounds?
That it was militant and that you needed to let the Lord work these things out and not be confrontational and so forth. And he really wasn't that much supportive of the movement. He encouraged his members to stay away from that. And
but your mom went anyway.
She went anyway, and she taught me to go anyway.
And the results of that decision, did people celebrate? Were there, I mean, how did people react to the news that, that major businesses in town were ending segregation policies, that this had worked?
She reacted very, very well because she was down there. And she was around those stores all the time, every day. And so when she could go in them and be treated differently than she was before, it did make a big difference.
And then in April 1962, there was a city ordinance banning discrimination in hotels and restaurants. This sounds like a pretty major forerunner to the Civil Rights Act.
It was. I don't want to dominate the conversation.
Oh, no. As a matter of fact, you know, I have, you know, in 1959, of course, I was three, you know, but I have very vivid memories. My mother was very an activist, so to speak, because she, as a matter of fact, she was the first black nurse to have a supervisory position at the old St. Joseph Hospital on 31st Street. So my whole upbringing was change and understanding those things. So as I hear these, you know, these, and they said to connect the dots from Reverend Thompson, you know, as to how I've always lived my life. You know, it's an amazing situation of the legacy that was given. So I'm having a real good time hearing that everything that I've ever heard come into my household was based on things that were actual and things that I just kind of like picked up the mantle from. So, you know, if we can just continue in on this, if there's some time I can interject, I'm just having a real good time hearing it. So,
yeah, 1962.
You're supposed to dominate stuff if you were there.
And we will get back to Anita shortly. But yeah, for this section of history, I think you probably remember a little more clearly what it was like in 1962 when there was, in Kansas City, a city ordinance banning discrimination in hotels and restaurants.
Yeah, I graduated from high school in 1962. So I was aware for many of the discrimination kinds of things that went on in the movies. I remember when we could only go to certain movies very clearly. I remember when we could go through the plaza, but we'd get stopped. And the officers would always remind us to keep moving. You know, they'd stop
Sounds
us.
Sounds like and, today.
Yeah, they'd stop us and ask us, what are you doing here? And we'd say, well, we're just riding through this. And, well, keep moving.
Do you hear echoes of that today when you hear about the issues on the plaza now? I don't want to get too far off track, but Anita brought it up, so I think it's worth taking a moment to address.
Absolutely, but in those days, we couldn't have ever thought of gathering that many youngsters. We were stopped for just two or three together. We never had a chance to get to the point of having a riot, so to speak. But yeah, I can relate to it because, you know, when you're young and you're in high school and college, you want to go out and you want to do things. And if you don't have anything to do, what's expected of you?
Yeah.
And that's what happens when the kids don't have constructive things to be involved in, they get involved in destructive things.
So, yeah, let's pick up with, I do think it's interesting that the Civil Rights Act is nationally this groundbreaking piece of legislation, but that pieces of what it legislates have already been implemented through local city ordinances here. Because then in 1963, October of 1963, there was a local ordinance that extended the ban on discrimination in hotels and restaurants to any business open to the public. Do you think Kansas City was ahead of its time? A little bit ahead of the national curve?
It may have been a little bit, especially when you relate to the South and the segregation that went on in the South, where it was more accepted. You know, black people. I remember being involved in a march in Birmingham in the early days, just shortly after the four little girls were bombed in the church. And there were things that went on that we didn't have to deal with here in Kansas City.
Just a level of violence and vitriol?
Yeah, and you know, black people knew to stay in their place, and white people didn't show the respect for them that they did here in Kansas City.
So that's interesting to me that you feel like there was a level of respect that was shown here in Kansas City.
And from, you know, studying the civil rights movement and the various things like that, Kansas City, it was a prosperous town, you know, for many, many years during a number of things. Even though segregated, it was still prosperous on both ends. So there was always somewhat of, from what I've studied and seen and even grew up, there was somewhat of a dependency each one on another. You know, that wasn't seen in the South, that wasn't seen in those various places, because many of my people, just everyone was a homeowner. You know, just about everyone I knew had some type of government job or some type of profession or owned their own business. These were things that, you know, that the city within a city, that the black community was to Kansas City, that seems to be that dynamic as to why it was kind of easier, if you can say that, to accept those laws and things, because we were interdependent on each other for many years, particularly for the music, particularly because of who we were on the music scene of jazz and those various things. We could not continue to get the Count Basies and the people who came to town and made such a world difference had we not accepted that situation. That's an opinion, but, you know, that's based on what I've seen over a number of years.
Well, Anita Dixon, Executive Director of the Mutual Musicians Foundation, do you want to add anything else about these years leading up to the Civil Rights Act of 1964 right here in Kansas City? The jazz piece of it is really interesting.
Well, you know, there to be an activist who have followed Dr. King was everybody. So when you have names that are universally known across the world, the Duke Ellingtons, the Harry Belafontes, the Tony Bennett's, and the various people in the entertainment industry that supported that thing. And then you had so many of them that frequented Kansas City. You know, this type of legislation, it was, you know, an accepted practice now to come along and say, this is just stupid, and let's move ahead and do what we have to do. But when you have that kind of celebrity power behind something like that, then, you know, it makes a huge difference. It just really does. It makes a huge difference.
You've been listening to Anita Dixon of the Mutual Musicians Foundation and Reverend Nelson Fuzzy Thompson of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference talking to us today about this 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act. And let's get to the Civil Rights Act itself. It was proposed by John F. Kennedy, and his announcement comes in the wake of race riots that erupted as segregationists resisted school integration. Let's hear some old footage of Kennedy introducing his proposed Civil Rights Act to the nation.
Now the time has come for this nation to fulfill its promise. The events in Birmingham and elsewhere have so increased the cries for equality that no city or state or legislative body can prudently choose to ignore them. The fires of frustration and discord are burning in every city, north and south, where legal remedies are not at hand. Redress is sought in the streets, in demonstrations, parades, and protests, which create tensions and threaten violence and threaten lives. Next week, I shall ask the Congress of the United States to act, to make a commitment it has not fully made in this century to the proposition that race has no place in American life or law.
That was John F. Kennedy speaking in 1963. Reverend Thompson, is that a speech you remember hearing for the first time?
Yes, I do.
What did it feel like to hear those words?
Well, of course, in my family, John F. Kennedy was the first Democratic president that they had voted for. We were generally Republicans, and it was a big deal for us to support the John F. Kennedy. He was a ray of hope. He was a young man who had somewhat liberal views and took on the issues that were important to us. And so this speech, as well as many other actions that he took, was very, very well received by my family and generally by the black community.
Anita, when you hear that speech, how does it make you feel today?
It makes me understand when the switch from Republican to Democrats became a part of the black community experience. You know, of course, just like everyone, as you know, kid have John F. Kennedy, what he stood for, these were things that were discussed at dinner tables and things that were discussed as they used to call it, current events when you're in school. You know, and hearing this, I've heard it many times. And to understand that there is a defining point where when we stopped being Republican supporters and started being Democratic supporters in America. And I think that's very interesting to have watched and been in the middle of that dynamic, to have watched the last Republican go and then be a Democrat for another 50 years. That's interesting and bears another show.
Well, Reverend Thompson, you were just sort of talking about that, and you talked about the political feelings that surrounded Kennedy. But what about the emotional response that it must have struck you in some way really deep in your core, or did it?
Well, it did, because, again, he stood up for those same issues that were important to us as black people. And so we were drawn to him and to his family, to the whole Kennedy legacy. It was an important to our hopes and dreams and aspirations. And therefore, we took Kennedy, that's why we shifted from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party, as represented by Kennedy, reached out to us in a way that the Republican Party didn't and still doesn't to this day. I think we've been loyal Democrats ever since, and we still are. President Obama, President Clinton, other Democratic presidents who've been successful have received 90% or more of the black vote.
And Kennedy, of course, did not live to sign the Civil Rights Act into law, but on this day in 1964, his successor, Lyndon B. Johnson, did. The television networks gave him 15 minutes between 6:45 and 7 for the announcement. And let's hear some footage from that momentous occasion.
We must not approach the observance and enforcement of this law in a vengeful spirit. Its purpose is not to punish. Its purpose is not to divide, but to end divisions, divisions which have lasted all too long. Its purpose is national, not regional. This Civil Rights Act is a challenge to all of us to go to work in our communities and our states, in our homes and in our hearts, to eliminate the last vestiges of injustice in our beloved country. So, tonight I urge every public official, every religious leader, every business and professional man, every working man, every housewife, I urge every American to join in this effort to bring justice and hope to all our people and to bring peace to our land.
Reverend Thompson, this must have been an incredible moment to witness. I can't even imagine witnessing that broadcast. Tell us about what happened in Kansas City in response to the news that racial discrimination in public places was now illegal.
Well, I think this was a speech where President Johnson used the phrase, "We shall overcome." And for a white Southern president to use that phrase was really very, very heartening for us in the black community. And this day was an important day, and it still is, because even though this bill was signed into law, it's been a struggle every day trying to implement it and to make it a reality.
And it sounds like it was a struggle, in fact, on that first day.
Yes, it was.
Tell us about that first day.
Well, you know, I've learned more about it since I've gotten older than I knew then. But it was a struggle then, and it's still a struggle now. And President Johnson was very persuasive. And he did have the ear of many of the Southern Democrats as well as the Northern Democrats. And he was able to pull off probably what even President Kennedy wouldn't have been able to pull off, because he had a way of being able to cross the aisles and to relate to those persons in the South who were dead set against integration and the doing away with segregation.
You've mentioned something with both Kennedy and Johnson that kind of interests me. You mentioned with both of them, I think that the role of sympathetic white people in this movement is an interesting role. Can you talk a little bit about what it did mean to you that these people were white and were pushing for civil rights progress? And were there limits to what white people could or did do?
Yes, and there still are. If you look at Congress today, the white, primarily white, Southern political movement is dead set against President Obama on just about anything that he tries to do. He calls it the obstructionist movement, and they've been solidly against him. In fact, in some cases, they don't even take the time to look at what he's saying. It just, if it comes from him, they're against it. You can see that with the affordable health care law, which is sometimes referred to as the Obama health care.
And you see that as a racially motivated relationship and not just what politics do?
Absolutely.
Interesting. Could you talk more about that?
Well, it's clear that because he's black, he has had to suffer much opposition to his policies and to his dreams and hopes and what he sees as important for the country. In fact, the speech he gave a couple of days ago, he just flat said that he was going to have to go off on his own, because everything that he proposes is opposed by especially the Southern white political movement. And he had, in order for him to make any gains for the whole country, he has to move out on his own.
Absolutely.
Anita, what do you think? Do you think that Barack Obama is a civil rights leader in our time?
He had no choice to be a civil rights leader. As the first African-American president of the United States with a black wife and black children, what position do you put yourself in? To say that he is the person to his own, he's had a lot of help. He's had a lot of history. He knows how to navigate this thing called the presidency of the United States. But because of who and what he is, there is, as Reverend Thompson says, this terrible opposition, you know. But from what I can see, because of the technology that we enjoy now, people have their own opinions about things. And I'm seeing what they say about a liberal America, liberal whites particularly, that think and talk as many blacks do, you know. So I'm seeing kind of like a little bit of middle ground from that. That was because we only had several media back then, but now we've got hundreds of thousands of opportunities to get opinions and find facts. And so it's always amazing to me when I hear, you know, just blatant lies being told that can so quickly be substantiated, so quickly be, you know, Fox News. I mean.
Well, Anita, what does the Civil Rights Act mean to you today?
Civil Rights Act means to me? That's a very good question, because it's still something. It's still a study in progress for a person almost 60 years old, you know, to understand that I was the recipient, me and my people growing up in high school and going to high school were the recipients of the things that Reverend Thompson and those that came before us did. I got to, you know, I can only vaguely remember not being able to go places and various things like that. So,
well, Central Standard is going to take a short break. And when we get back, we'll want to hear from you. Call us to share your stories from Kansas City during the civil rights era. The number to call is 816-235-2888. That number again is 816-235-2888. We'll be back in a few. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with Anita Dixon of the Mutual Musicians Foundation and Nelson Fuzzy Thompson, a civil rights icon here in Kansas City. He's the president of the local chapter of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and we're commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, signed into law on July 2nd, 1964. Call us to share your memories of the civil rights movement in Kansas City or to ask Reverend Thompson about his experiences. The number is 816-235-2888. The number again, 816-235-2888. And Reverend Thompson, while we're lining up those calls, I'd like to ask you about some of your other experiences. You had a close relationship with Nelson Mandela and were active in fighting apartheid in South Africa. Can you tell us about that?
It was a wonderful experience of a lifetime. I was a part of two delegations that went to South Africa, one before Mr. Mandela was released and one just afterwards when he ran for president and was elected. 4 years after being released from prison, he was elected president, and that was quite an experience. I saw and witnessed many South Africans, black South Africans, vote for the very first time in their life. And that was quite an experience. I shall never forget it, and I'll always be appreciative of the opportunity to go.
When you witnessed a movement in another context with a whole different set of circumstances that people were rising up against, but yet, of course, some resonance, what do you think is the relationship between these two movements? Did witnessing what was going on in South Africa make you think differently about what had happened here at home and what you were still a part of here at home?
Well, I began to really understand the importance of voting and the significance of voting and taking full advantage of that opportunity. When you saw people who got up and went to the polls the night before and stood up or slept or somehow were ready when the polls opened at 6 a.m., they had been in line all night long waiting for that opportunity. And I visited many polling places that everybody on the rolls had voted by noon, and so they closed the polls down and sent everybody home because there wasn't anybody else to vote.
Wow.
And I saw people who quietly, because you couldn't make any noise or any confusion. And like we are here accustomed to electioneering, there was no electioneering, no passing out ballots or any of that kind of stuff. They had to be very quiet, very dignified, or therefore jeopardize the opportunity to vote. And these people voted, many of them elderly, had lived their whole lives without that right in their native land. And so I saw something and experienced something that made me always recognize the importance of voting.
And you were sort of called to the mat, as it were, when the Rodney King scenario played out in Los Angeles and riots were erupting in cities nationwide in the 1990s. You were brought in to address crowds in Kansas City to guide people's response locally. Is that right?
Yes, I was. I was speaking when it first happened. I was speaking at a rally on the steps of the county courthouse downtown. And it was that day that we set a major rally the next day at Spirit of Freedom Fountain. And I remember there was a group of young men, especially, who wanted to go to the plaza. And Mayor Cleaver had just been elected. And Mayor Cleaver, myself, Alvin Brooks, and many others stopped those young men, and we were able to have a rally there at the Spirit of Freedom Fountain where we allowed every single person. I stood there myself, I know, all day long and allowed every single person who wanted to speak, speak. And it was an eight-year-old girl, little girl, who spoke and said, you know, we were, violence was not the way. If we wanted to change things, we had to get out and get in our community and get involved, and we could change them. But violence wasn't the way.
This is a tremendous responsibility. Such a huge thing is happening, and people's emotions are so worked up around that thing. And to be called in to sort of guide the response and bring both the courage to stand up about what's happening and also the calm to do it with dignity, I mean, that is a huge responsibility.
Well, for one thing, I didn't have any warning. I got a call, and I was told to come down to the county courthouse for a rally, and I didn't even really know what had happened. And then on the way down there, I realized that listening to public radio, I realized that Rodney King had been beat up, and this was in response to that verdict and all of the stuff that had happened in Los Angeles. But I just allowed the Lord to guide me and direct me. And I felt at peace. I felt at ease. I was not nervous. But the Lord really gave me the strength to deal with that situation as it unfolded.
You are a reverend. How does your work in civil rights relate to your ministry?
It's everything. My ministry is really a response to the call that I've received from the Lord to do His will and to follow His lead in this world today. So that's the foundation of my involvement, the spiritual.
There's a long history of the Black church being very active in social justice issues. Do you think that the Black church still has that sort of special role today or even a special responsibility today?
Absolutely. And it's the initiation of the movement in the church and in the spirit-filled world that makes a real difference. Because generally, we don't have the resources to fight these overwhelmingly discriminatory activity. But with the Lord on our side, we can overcome anything.
Anita Dixon, I want to turn back to you and talk to you. We've been hearing from one of the incredible leaders of the civil rights movement here in Kansas City, Reverend Nelson Fuzzy Thompson. And there were other leaders who were very active in the movement here. And I wonder if you can tell us about some of them.
Well, some of them I've researched, of course, as Reverend Thompson probably knew them personally. Bernard Powell, that coined the phrase in Washington, "We must go from ghetto to gold mine," to talk about the economic opportunities that were prevalent and the things that we needed to do to bolster the community on our own.
So ghetto to gold mine, that is to say, you can leave your community or you can make it into the best thing it can be.
And the best thing that it can be. And as part of the understanding of that and part of the memorial, because there's a civil rights tour that I do, and that goes into the history of the civil rights movement in Kansas City and does outline these particular people like Leon Jordan and Bernard Powell.
Tell us about Leon Jordan.
Well, you know, from what I'm understanding and from what I've heard, anyway.
He's become personal, controversial again.
Exactly. You know, a gentleman that went to Liberia, you know, to help with the police state and understanding more there, highly intelligent. Came back assassinated in Kansas City, you know, for a number of things. You have the dynamics of the civil rights movement, not only externally that had to do with governmental issues and things of that effect and desegregation, but you also had internal problems in the African-American communities, those that, like Reverend Thompson said, did not agree with some of us who may not have agreed with Dr. King, and didn't agree with Bernard Powell, did not agree. So our internal problems were also a part of that history, the assassinations, as many people say, you know, were done internally by African Americans like Malcolm X and various things of that effect. So when you have those dynamics going on and you understand that this movement and the things that this community feels, particularly when I hear things like the Black Church, well, the aspects of the Black Church are varied and huge and historic.
Absolutely.
You know? And
fair.
So it's hard for me to say, to hear when I hear things like, what does the Black Church? Because the Black Church is so different and so varied. And particularly now when you have your mega church opportunities and things to that effect, I don't really look at us any longer as being economically strapped in that when I see these people 10,000 strong going to church. I do see a lack, however, of turning back to the community and to the history and to the various things that we need. And, you know, I'm kind of like, I attend church and things like that, but I'm kind of like a let's get off our knees and get back to, you know, understanding what needs to be done in this new civil rights era after 50 years of what I've witnessed. So there is quite a bit of history that's going on, I'm sure.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I'm sitting here with Anita Dixon of the Mutual Musicians Foundation. She also leads tours of the civil rights history here in Kansas City, and Reverend Nelson Fuzzy Thompson from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He is the president of our local chapter here. And I want to get to our callers. Let's talk to Joe in Midtown. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. Number one, I want to thank the station for this fine program. I know both of the guests, and seems like they've taken away some of my thoughts about where we have, where we ought to be today, and maybe the need for more churches and civil rights organizations to be able to gain members to do what we need to do to advance all those things that could make this nation a more perfect union. So, to those who are listening, and especially your guests. Thanks for what you've done and what you will help us do in the future.
You're very welcome, Joe. You've made a major contribution yourself, and so congratulations to you as well.
Joe, why don't you tell us about your contribution?
Well, on this date in 1964, I was serving my country in Germany, but one of the things about growing up in Kansas, not growing up in Kansas City, but coming to visit Kansas City during the time that we're talking about, I was denied the right to see a movie at the Waldo Theater. This theater is gone now, but the movie that I wanted to see, which I had heard about in history, was Gone with the Wind. But they told me that I could not patronize that movie theater, and I did file a complaint with the Human Relations Commission at the time that did not have a department, and they did get a letter back a couple of months that they were going to desegregate the Waldo Theater. But many people in Kansas City have outstanding stories about what they've done to help, you know, large and small, and I just think that I was here to see some of it. You know, from 1965 to now, the progress that has been made by the marchers and the protesters and the writers, many of them. And I went to school with Bernard Powell and so forth and so on. But good program, and thank you for it.
Thanks, Joe. And, you know, he talked about thanking both of you for the work you are still going to do. But Reverend, what is the work that you are still doing now? What are your goals today?
Well, as a matter of fact, we just finished choosing a theme for the 2015 King celebration here in metropolitan Kansas City. We have a very extensive celebration of Dr. King's birthday. We are actually the second largest in the world, I mean in the country, and we really know that we're the largest. But this year coming up, 2015, the theme is going to be investing in the community for economic justice.
The economic piece of it is interesting. Do you think that the sort of original civil rights movement addressed economics sufficiently?
Yes, it did the best it could. But we still have a very long way to go in economics. We've made gains in every area, in every arena. With electing the president, I probably didn't think that was possible a few years ago. But now we have a very wonderful president with a wonderful family, and he sets a beautiful example for the nation and this world. But we still have a lot of poverty, extreme poverty, especially in the black community and the Hispanic community. We still have a lack of jobs and job training. We still need businesses in our community, in our own community, where the dollar can turn over several times before it is pushed out into the larger community. We still have some real economic challenges.
And speaking of today's challenges, this week for our Tell KCUR series, we're asking listeners this very question. What are today's biggest challenges for civil rights? How can we overcome them? If you want to participate in that conversation, go to our website, kcur.org, to find out how. We'll be sharing people's answers on the air during tomorrow's Central Standard. But back to the studio, Anita Dixon, what do you think? What do you think is the work to be done in civil rights now?
Probably the work to be done from the forefront is the digital divide problem.
Explain that.
The digital divide problem, the access to things that others have that we are now fighting as they like being able to access a store back in 50 years ago. Now we need to access internet. We need to access the various technology and then be knowledgeable about how it works. I'm glad to be here on the show because the Mutual Musicians Foundation is working with the Freedom Network Foundation. We actually installed Wi-Fi on 18th and Vine for 3 blocks and giving free Wi-Fi to demonstrate the importance, because everything is technology now. And as we began to talk about civil rights, the big companies and things that are still a part of our lives that are now become different names, you know, that they've just traded hands. So now the technology divide is one of the things I feel that economically, if we do not get in the forefront of that and understand for our children and for our economic parity, if we do not have access to these things, we are 50 years ago, as we were 50 years ago. So that's one of the most important things, I think, is what we're doing, what needs to be identified.
We've got another caller who's ready to weigh in on the history again. We've got Steve on the plaza. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thank you very much. Fuzzy, I understand you haven't talked about the citywide vote. I think it was 65 for public housing in Kansas City. The council passed an ordinance allowing African Americans to not be denied public housing and rentals, et cetera. And the John Birch Society, which was the Tea Party of its day, did a referendum, and we had to go to a citywide vote. National attention, Dr. King came here. Were you active in that event? It was quite a turning point for political activity by the black community.
I was active as I could be, being a college student at that time. But I remember it very well. And, of course, housing is always a challenge. It's still a challenge. And we appreciate the effort that you and many other persons made to give equal opportunity in housing and are still making.
And, Reverend, speaking of things that came after the Civil Rights Act, in Kansas City, there were some episodes that people remember very clearly. I'm thinking specifically of the riots in 1968. Can you talk about those and what you experienced at that time?
Well, I was in college. And I can remember coming home from college and being confronted by tanks and smelling the gunpowder in the air, a smell and an attitude, an atmosphere that I'd never experienced, especially in Kansas City. I didn't know. I'd heard about it, read about it, but I had never experienced it. And it was really a frightening kind of experience. I was told to go straight home, turn your lights on, don't go anywhere else because you could be arrested. You could be confronted by military equipment that was roaming the streets. It was really a very frightening time here in Kansas City, and I remember it. And I sincerely hope we don't have to go through that ever again.
Yeah, what lessons do you think we can learn from that?
Well, we've all got to learn to live together. And as Dr. King said, we learn to live together as brothers and sisters or die apart as fools. And that's still very much the case. We've got to have peace and harmony. We've got to have mutual understanding and respect. We've got to have these things that make it possible for all of us to have an opportunity to reach our full potential in this life.
Anita, do you remember the riots of 1968?
I can remember my older brother being involved and my mother having to send him for a Greyhound bus to be picked up and bought to Colorado, where she was, because things had gotten so out of hand. My grandma lived over on 41st and College, so right down, you know, where he was going to school. And Central High School and things like that. I remember that happening and him getting in a fight and tear gas or something like that. It was something to that effect, you know, as I can remember. And then him being immediately put on a bus and brought to Colorado.
The civil rights movement does extend far beyond the Civil Rights Act that we're commemorating today. Any other milestones coming up that you think we should be looking forward to commemorating, celebrating?
Oh, for me, the Local 627, the founding of Local 627 in 1917, we're looking forward to our 100th year celebration in about 3 years.
Explain what the 627 was.
Local 627 was the Black Musicians Union that started in 1917 as part of the American Federation of Musicians, and is actually considered to be ground zero for the swing era of music in America.
That is all the time we have for today's look back at the Civil Rights Act 50 years later. Our guests have been Anita Dixon of the Mutual Musicians Foundation and Reverend Nelson Fuzzy Thompson of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Thank you so much for coming to the studio today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Tomorrow, we'll visit Ivanhoe to learn about the challenges and triumphs of residents who have been working to turn that neighborhood around. To listen back to any of the shows you hear on Central Standard, just go to kcur.org/Central Standard. You can also follow us on Twitter. @KCURCST is our handle. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's it for today. Stick around for Up to Date, coming right up next.